Thank you, Mr. Howard. Good afternoon, everybody. I counted 22 from my seat. It might be different than that. The weather has a strange effect on our attendance. This past year at the Feast of Tabernacles, Mr. Bob Fay was speaking, and I think it was the first sermon that he gave two. He was reading from, I believe, the book of Isaiah, and he talked about a time of peace and truth. And then he stopped, and he looked up and he said, "You can't have peace without truth." And that kind of stuck in my head. And when I got home, I started thinking and I said, what else can't you have peace without? Because there must be other things besides truth that you can't have peace without. And I guess I came up with about 100 different things. That if aren't present, you don't have peace. But I couldn't talk about 100 different things today. So I've chosen 7 of the elements of peace. I call them elements of peace. Now, why 7? Well, it seems that whenever somebody gives a sermon and they talk about a number of something, it's always 7, so I chose 7. So this is the title today, 7 Elements of Peace. I've heard more than one minister say that peace is more than the absence of war. If we're out in the backyard on a summer day relaxing in our hammock with a good book and a little lemonade by our side, and there's all kinds of mosquitoes flying in our face, we don't have peace. If we're stressed at work, there's no war, but we don't have peace. If we're stressed by a severe illness, we don't have peace. If hail is falling on our head, we don't have peace. If one or more neighbors is constantly harassing us, we don't have peace. If a loved one dies suddenly, we don't have peace. Now, I could go on, but I stopped at 6 there. Dictionary.com defines peace as a non-warring condition of the world. But they go on. They go on to add freedom from civil commotion and violence in the community. Okay, well, we've seen that in Ferguson lately. Civil commotion. They add cessation from freedom from any strife or dissension. Freedom from annoyance, distraction, anxiety, obsession, etc. They conclude a state of tranquility, serenity. And that's pretty accurate. But then they really conclude it because they say, may he rest in peace. So I guess that what they're saying is that death is peace. Okay. We are all offered, brethren, you and I, peace at all times. Let's turn to Luke, the 2nd chapter. Jesus Christ offered us peace when he was born, and just before he died. At the time of his birth, the angels announced it. In Luke 2, verse 13, we read, Luke 2, 13, suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host, praising God and saying, glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. Now, we've heard in the past that this could be translated peace to men of goodwill. In fact, Mr. Kubik wrote that to us lately. And that's probably the more accurate translation. The fact of the matter is that what's happening here is that Christ is offering peace to men of goodwill. So who are the men of goodwill? Well, I would say those who are striving to become like God. Let's look at John 14. Now, this is just before the death of Jesus Christ. John 14, verse 27. Speaking to his disciples in verse 27 of John 14, Jesus says, peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you, not as the world gives to you, do I give to you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. Okay, seven elements of peace. I start with truth. Mr. Fay said we need truth for peace. And that's really true. Oh, what a tangled web we weave. Lies cause problems. They create a condition that's not peaceful. I've considered that before Satan told the first lie, that there never had been a lie told in all of eternity. And yet when he spoke to Adam, spoke to Eve the first time, the first thing he did was tell her a lie. We listen to the leaders of our nation, we listen to the leaders of other nations, and we can see why people don't trust people. We watch our leaders run for political office, and it just seems that there's one stretching of the truth upon another. We can trust God's word 100%. Lies cause suspicion. We don't have to be suspect of God's word. Let's look at Job, the 13th chapter. Now, Job was in a horrible condition. It wasn't a peaceful condition. Job was covered with sores and he was hurting, and he'd been hurting a long time, severely hurting. And his friends were trying to help him out. His friends were trying to correct him and show him that he could feel better if he'd listened to them. So in Job 13, verse 4, he says to them, "You're forgers of lies, you're worthless physicians." I guess he could see what they were saying wasn't true, and he says, "You're not helping me. You're not helping me get better." I'm sure that, brethren, you and I have considered that when Jesus Christ returns, we'll all be teachers, one way or another. And you got to know that we're going to be teaching 100% truth, for sure. I grew up in Madison. I went to school in Madison. When it came time to go to college, this was the late 50s, early 60s, it was very inexpensive for me to go across the street, put a dime into the slot of the bus, and ride it out to college campus. And the tuition was cheap, too, by comparison to today. And I've compared dollars, and it was. I could pay my tuition and books and have money to live just off my summer job. You can't do that now unless you really have a good summer job. Before I started going to school out there, my dad, who had taught there, said to me, "There's a lot of politics goes on at the University of Wisconsin." I didn't know what that meant. I thought it meant Republicans and Democrats. Well, I learned on many different occasions that there's a lot of politics going on out there, as I suppose there is everywhere. My junior year, I took a course in American history, and I loved it. Oh, man, I just loved it. Now, a few years has gone by since then, but at that time, about half of our history went through the Civil War. So the first semester, I studied through the Civil War. Easy, got an A. I mean, it was probably an A+. It was just such an easy course for me. I just really enjoyed it. So I signed up for a second semester, but, you know, in the second semester, I got a different teacher. And I soon learned that this teacher, for want of a better way to say it, he put a spin on historical events that kind of made things go the way his political views wanted them to go. I heard recently in the news that the leader of Russia today wants to rewrite the history books. In fact, I've even heard of that going on in this country. And the reason is that he didn't like things that were said about what was happening in his country, historically speaking. Well, that's pretty much what was going on in my history class. And when we get an exam, he didn't ask us true-false questions or say, "What happened on this date? What happened on this date?" He'd give us what they called essay questions. We'd have to write something down, you know, tell a little story about these events. And, you know, if they didn't match his slant on things, we got graded off. Needless to say, I didn't get an A in that course. Now, that was not the only time that there was politics involved, but I could see that what was going on in that class wasn't truth, and it caused me a lot of stress that was not peace. Second element of peace, protection. What in the world is that about? What do we need protection from? God offers us protection, even today. I think that God offers us protection today a lot more than we ever think about. You know, we walk around, we see this, we see that, we do this, we do that. But the fact is that in many instances, I think God is caring for us and we are not even aware of it. Let's look at Leviticus 26, please, and we'll look at verse 6. Leviticus 26. Recall, Leviticus 26 is one of what we call the blessings and cursings chapters. So what God has said in advance of this verse, verse 6, is that if you obey me, these things are going to take place. Now, you know, that's a very simple formula. And I've concluded that in my mind wherever he says something like that. If you obey me, this is going to happen. But somehow, when Satan puts that temptation in front of people, that concept of obeying God can get put on the back burner. Leviticus 26:6, emphasis on I. He says, I will give you peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none will make you afraid. I will rid the land of evil beasts, and the sword will not go through your land. Let's look at the Exodus 15 and see something that to me is really amazing. Exodus 15. We'll look at verse 26. Where again he gives us this simple formula. If you obey me. Exodus 15, verse 26. Verse 26 of Exodus 15. He says, if you diligently heed the voice of the Eternal, your God, and do what's right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians. For I am the Lord who heals you. Consider that. God puts diseases on people. I've heard lately that we're conquering AIDS. I don't know if that's true or not. But 5 years ago, I never heard of Ebola. Where'd that come from? What's this Ebola stuff? And what's in the future? God says he puts diseases on people. Not if they're obeying him. He doesn't want that. This isn't peace. Back in Leviticus, when we were reading in Leviticus 26, it said he'll rid the land of dangerous animals. When I grew up, I was a half a block from the lake. Now, we used to think of Madison's having two lakes. Actually, I guess it has four. Living there, they always used to say it had five, but I could never figure out where the fifth one was. But I lived a half a block from a public beach. Consider that for your playground when you're a child. We didn't have, you know, these video games and stuff when I was a boy. But it was more than just the beach. Oh, the lake was a wonderful thing. Oh, you could walk on the Indian trails. Man, you could do everything. You'd come to a dead fish. That was great stuff for a boy, you know. I used to get up pretty early, too. I'd get up because in those days, parents didn't have to worry so much about their kids being snatched if they were somewhere. So at 6 o'clock one Sunday morning, I was down at the beach swimming by myself, obviously. Nobody else, no one in their right mind was going to be down there swimming at that time of the day. And they had ropes and floating devices in the back to pen off the area where you could swim. And there was a pier that you could go in and dive off and jump. Well, I was done swimming. It was probably about 6:45. I was sitting on a picnic table that was pulled to a position where the lifeguard, when he was there, could sit on it and look over the beach. And it was early, like I say, about 6:45, and I could see a woman approaching me, coming across what I'll call the park. She had a small child with her. And she came up to me and she asked me, she said, are there any dangerous fish in this lake? She wanted to let her child swim, not at that moment, but later in the day. And she was concerned that there were dangerous fish. Now, I had visions of sharks and stingrays and jellyfish and stuff. I said, there's northerns, you know, there's bass and carp and bullheads and stuff. You put your finger in the mouth of a northern, I suppose, you get bit. But you jump in the lake and the northern's going to swim away. They're not really dangerous as far as swimming is concerned. One of my favorite TV shows to watch, I don't watch it very often because I don't think it's on very often. Don't be shocked now, okay? It's called River Monsters. It's about a guy from Australia. I think his name is Jeremy Wade. And they got a whole team of people, I'm sure, they go all around the globe. He doesn't fish in the ocean. He fishes only fresh water. And he doesn't go there just to catch fish. He goes there to catch fish with a purpose. He goes to a certain spot which his producers have figured out for him. If, in fact, at that spot, a human being was either severely injured or killed by a fish in fresh water. One of my favorites was a fish. It was just beautiful. Oh, it was beautiful. And the first thing I thought was, that's a clean fish. It was fins and scales with silver. It was probably about a 15-pound fish, maybe 20, 25. Had orange tail, orange fins. Oh, it was lovely. It was called the tiger fish. Had fangs about an inch, like that. Stupid fish. I mean, you know, it's a fish that's that. You know, they just sit there. You know, they don't know, I think, what they're doing. But it had fangs that were an inch long. Now, in another program where someone had been killed, he caught this fish's cousin, which was called the Goliath tiger fish, which can go close to 400 pounds, and the fangs, and I mean fangs, were about 3 inches long. That would be like this. And underwater, if you got attacked by one of these fish, and this is fresh water where people would sometimes, I guess, swim. God says he rids the land of evil beasts. God's protection brings us peace. Element number three, patience. Can't have peace without patience. You ever heard the expression, the patience of the saints? That's us. That's us. We've all had a neighbor or a boss who was impatient. Now, I'm sure that none of us ever feel impatient. Remember the old joke says, I want patience and I want it now? Where I live, we have four different types of rental stores. First is called Rent-A-Center, then there was Aaron's. And the fourth one is called Sears. Yeah, Sears was ready to go under, but now they have come into the black again by, instead of just selling their appliances and their high-tech devices, they're renting them. But the fourth one is the one that I think they should all be named. It's called Get It Now. I saw a truck out here a couple weeks ago that said Get It Now, and I thought, this really describes what they all are, isn't it? Get It Now. Of course, this creates a situation of debt, and debt isn't peace. Okay, let's take a look at what Paul says as far as our treatment with one another. Turn to Romans, please, the 12th chapter. Romans 12. We can't have peace without patience. Romans 12, and we'll look at verses 10, 11, and 12. I will patiently wait for you to turn there. Romans 12, verse 10. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love and honor, giving preference to one another, not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer. The tribulation may involve other people or it may not. An illness can be tribulation, can't it? But we're told by the God of peace to be patient. Patience produces peace, and we can't have peace without patience. Element number four, mercy. Mercy. It should be easy to see how mercy can produce peace. Wherever there's a physical confrontation, if one who could come down hard on the other offers mercy, it's an obvious bringer of peace. What about a person who's anxious for whatever reason? A person who's stressed over something that was said or done, you know, only to have the victim suddenly show him or her mercy. It's a peace bringer. Our God is a God of mercy, brethren. I usually, and I'm not saying you should do what I do, but I usually begin every one of my prayers by thanking God for his mercy. Who of us would be alive today if not for the mercy of God? You know, there's mercy shown in ways that we don't even think about. Let's look at Hosea, the second chapter. Hosea. I just consider that probably all of us tend to take God's mercy for granted. I'm not trying to pick on anybody by saying that. It's just something that's easy to do. Hosea 2, verse 19. He says, I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and justice, in loving kindness and mercy. Skip forward to verse 23. He's not just talking to us at this point. Verse 23 of Hosea 2, he says, then I will sow her for myself in the earth, and I will have mercy on her who had not obtained mercy. And I will say to those who were not my people, you are my people. And they will be, say, you are my God. They shall say, you are my God. That involves everybody, doesn't it? God is going to show mercy to every single living human being. But of course, God is perfect. God says he gives us his grace. Grace could be called mercy. It is. Who among us has ever experienced perfection? Well, none of us, so we're all needing God's grace. Grace is given because of the weakness of the flesh. Without mercy, there couldn't be peace. Element number five. Element number five, encouragement. Who doesn't appreciate encouragement when it's given? When we're correct on something, we like to be encouraged for it. Oh, we did a good job. We like to be encouraged. What about when we aren't correct? What about when we make a mistake? We still like to be encouraged, don't we? If we're ill and physically down, we like it when somebody calls us and encourages us. If we break down the word encourage, it says either we are putting courage in or we're having courage put into us. The Word of God is filled with encouragement. Dictionary.com uses the synonym inspire. It says inspiration is encouragement. Well, it sure is. I consider inspiration to be from God when he puts his spirit into us, and that certainly is encouraging. Let's look at 2 Chronicles. God's spirit provides encouragement, and God's spirit is working with every single soul in this room, brethren. No matter how old we are or how young. 2 Chronicles chapter 30. Now, this is speaking of Hezekiah. Had a very happy time. Hezekiah, of course, was a righteous king of Judah. 2 Chronicles 30, verse 22. It says, Hezekiah gave encouragement to all the Levites who taught the good knowledge of the Eternal, and they ate throughout the feast 7 days, offering peace offerings and making confession to the Lord God of their fathers. When we get down, sometimes it's easy to kind of forget about Matthew 6, where Christ tells us not to worry. Not to worry. You know, I got a question for you. How many times can you remember in your readings of the Bible when Jesus Christ became unsettled? I don't mean upset or angry. I mean unsettled. Because I can't remember one. I mean, even the night before his death, he drew to the Father. He gave us the perfect example. You don't have to turn here, but in 1 Thessalonians 3, Paul asked Timothy to go to the people and encourage them concerning their faith. He couldn't go, so he asked Timothy to go, to encourage the brethren. We can experience the absence of war without encouragement, brethren, but we can't experience true peace. The last two of my elements I consider personal helps. Personal helps. Like I say, there's probably well over 100 elements of peace. But for number six, I chose a willingness to accept correction. Sometimes it seems that we just know that we have all the right answers. Let's take a look at Proverbs, the 10th chapter. Proverbs, the 10th chapter. Proverbs 10, we'll look at verse 17. The Proverbs have a way of saying an awful lot without saying a lot of words. Proverbs 10:17, it says, he who keeps instruction away is in the way of life, but he who refuses correction goes astray. Now jump up to chapter 12 and read the first verse, which says in essence the same thing, but it says it a little bit differently. I kind of go for this one. Whoever loves instruction loves knowledge, but he who hates correction is stupid. Oh boy, I can remember Mr. Owensby's talking about sitting in the room with his boss. His boss had a shot of whiskey in one hand and a cigar in the other hand, and he was correcting Mr. Dave Owensby's. When I was brand new in real estate, which was 1981, that's a few years ago, I had said something stupid. I had opened my big mouth. And the boss called me in his office, and he shut the door, and oh, he's going up one wall and down the other, and I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, I really don't like this, but I know he's right. God can use anybody to correct us. Being able to accept and appreciate correction is a peacemaker for every human being. Okay, number seven. Seventh element of peace. So easy to say. It's just so easy to say. Humility. Humility is a peacemaker. And the word just rolls off my tongue. Humble. Humble. It's doing it that's a little bit different than saying it. I was in an auto store lately. Well, it wasn't really an auto store. It was a store that sold auto parts as part of its business. I needed a headlight. And when I was young, I'd just buy a headlight and put it in. But nowadays, it seems you have to take the motor out to put the headlight in. So I wanted them to put the headlight in for me. The gal who was waiting on me was about 25 years old. She had a big name tag on. And it gave her name, and then underneath it, it said department head. So I remarked about it. I said, you're the head of the automotive department. She said, yes. Now, there were many people out in the fix-it shop, you know, the shop area where they were actually doing the putting tires on and batteries in and lining things up and all that kind of stuff. But there were four people who were working with her taking orders and stuff like that. And all of them were men, and all of them were quite a bit older. The youngest, I would say, was 45 years old. There were a couple who were in their 60s. And it became evident to me very quickly that she enjoyed bossing them around a lot. She was in charge, and she liked to boss them around to a fault. In fact, at one point, she was looking for a certain document, and she knew that this one guy had thrown it away, and she's digging in the garbage, and not finishing typing out my order, she's digging in the garbage can. She, what did you do with this? And finally she realized, because he kind of told her, it's up here where you put it. It was on the counter. And I didn't snicker or anything, but I thought to myself, do you ever consider this? This is something I've thought about quite a bit. In the Bible, we read about people who have, through God, accomplished mighty acts of what I'll call faith. And yet, none of those acts ever really come until after that person has attained humility. Consider Moses. Consider the acts of faith that Moses, God, accomplished through Moses. At the age of 40, Moses wasn't really very humble. The Egyptian did what he didn't like. So he jumped up and killed him. That's not really, I guess, a definition of humility, where you kill the guy when he does something bad, you know. 40 years of keeping sheep later, and Moses was more ready to do what he wanted. How about Samson? Now, Samson, he picked up a couple of gates that probably weighed about 1,500 pounds apiece, carried him a couple miles. I imagine he was feeling like he could take on the world. And when Delilah asked him what the source of his strength was, he told her it was his hair. Now, I grew up, like I say, in the early 60s, there were a lot of what was called hippies around. I always liked that word, hippie. I thought it was kind of funny. Hippies. If hair gave Samson strength, man, these guys would have been powerhouses. But none of them really were. Near the end of his life, he prayed to God. I suppose he prayed to God quite a bit, frankly. I mean, when I consider pushing around a wheel that grinds a grain all day long, I suppose he spent quite a bit of time with God, and I suspect that humility was gained quite a bit. And the prayer that we read in the book of Judges is a very short prayer asking for strength, but I suspect it was really much longer than that. Let's look at Psalm 45. Psalm 45, we look at two verses, and these will be verses 3 and verses 4 of Psalm 45. And again, emphasis on the pronoun your, the capital letters on the word your. Guys, here they are all capitalized. So we're speaking of God himself. Psalm 45, verse 3 and 4. Psalm 45, verse 3. gird your sword upon your thigh, O Mighty One, with your glory and your majesty, and in your majesty ride prosperously because of truth, humility, and righteousness, and your right hand shall teach you awesome things. Brethren, we're talking about God here, and it's describing God as humble. Imagine that. In the world today, we don't see much humility. It's been now 4 years since the church broke up for the last time, most recent time. I know I've often suggested that I've never seen the church break, and I've seen it break a number of times. I've never seen it break up because of too much humility. I didn't include righteousness among the seven elements of peace, and I'll tell you why I didn't. I consider that if you had an enormous bowl and you put in all of the elements of peace, couple that with all of what I've in the past called the applications of God's love, and you put them all into that bowl, what you'd have is righteousness, perfect righteousness like God has. Let's look at Isaiah 32, at a couple of verses here, 16 and 17. It says in Hebrews 12 that God trains us in righteousness, which leads to peace. God trains us in righteousness, which leads to peace. Look at Isaiah 32, verse 16. Isaiah 32, verse 16 and 17. Then justice will dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness remain in the fruitful field. The effect of righteousness, or all the components of peace, will be peace. The effect of righteousness will be peace, and the result of righteousness, quietness, and truth forever. Today, brethren, the earth is filled with sin, isn't it? Turmoil comes from sin, which is the opposite of peace. Peace today, we dream of it. Tomorrow it will be the way it always is. It says in Philippians 4, 7, that the peace of God passes understanding. Well, it does today. When Christ returns, his peace will no longer pass understanding. It will fill the earth, and it will be the way that we all live. And we all long for that day.